Welcome to the University of Washington's Political Economy Forum. We bring together diverse scholars, policymakers, and citizens to discuss current public policy issues, to inform the public about them, and to find evidence-based solutions. Feel free to visit our website at uwpoliticaleconomy.com. We publish new episodes of this podcast every week. If you have questions or suggestions for discussion topics, please contact us on Twitter at ForumUW or email us at uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you. Hello, everyone. My name is Nicholas Wittstock, and this episode is my conversation with Sean Bottomley, Senior Fellow in History at Northumbria University. We speak about Sean's research into the Court of Wards, a medieval English legal institution. While this may sound obscure at first, our conversation quickly explains the relevance of Sean's research, which effectively explores how different legal rules and their effects on property rights affect investment and ultimately economic growth. So without further ado, I bring you Sean Bottomley.
Hello, Sean Bottomley.
Hello, Nicholas.
Nice to have you on. Sean, you're a legal and economic historian, and today I want to discuss with you how, in an abstract sense, legal and economic institutions influence economic investment and innovation, ultimately development. So more specifically, your recent work has focused indirectly on the British Industrial Revolution, which is probably one of the most discussed events in this context of the economic institutions, economic development. Why are people so obsessed with this event of the British Industrial Revolution?
Probably only really speak for myself. It's essentially, it's the beginning of modernity. It marks the beginning of modern economic growth, a fundamental change in the human, in the sort of material condition of man. You know, frankly, I think you can almost put everything, if you really wanted to clarify the last 10,000 years of human history, I think you look at it in pre and post-industrialization. So it's an important event. And perhaps a slight gloss on that is the curiosity that it begins on what's a fairly small rainy island off the Eurasian landmass. It's an important event, intrinsically interesting, but it's also something of a mystery. Like why does it happen, where it does, and when it does?
Yeah, absolutely, right? I think people have really been trying to come up with different necessary conditions, different types of explanations. Why was it here? Why not anywhere else? Is there anything in terms of a necessary condition that was present in Britain that is not present in places where industrialization or economic development has struggled to take hold in other parts of the world? One such factor, I suppose, that scholars have pointed towards are property rights. What are property rights?
In its simplest, you would think of it as the outright ownership. We'll be talking a lot about land, so let's, for simplicity, talk about land. The outright ownership of land, the right to exclude other people from using that property. But we can unbundle it a little bit more, I think. It's the right, like I say, to protect it from intrusion, the right to enjoy an income from that property.
There are instances, right, where you have a right to, as you say, exclude others from it and to gain an income, but you're not allowed to sell it because it's actually held in co-ownership or something.
So that would be the right to dispose of it. That would be sort of, let's say, a sort of a working definition. And I think the reason why, and then there's the first sort of part of your question about, which I think is important, is thinking about an explanation for the Industrial Revolution that sort of not only provides a powerful account for why England industrial, but you also have to simultaneously explain why that factor either doesn't exist or doesn't operate in all other economies that existed before England in, let's say, 1750, 1800. That's difficult to do. Mm. For instance, you might talk about, which people have, is they might say, well, slavery. England was a capital-starved economy in the 17th century. The money earned on the extremely profitable slave trade, that was one of the things that helped capitalize the Industrial Revolution. I mean, the problem, to my mind, with that argument is you then have to explain why didn't the Roman Empire invest? Why doesn't the Ottoman Empire? Property rights, potentially, offers a way in, I think, to this question. And it's not so much that we're talking about strength of property rights in that you own the land and you can exclude other people from using it, because there's been good work say on France that's shown that property rights are actually very, very strong in France, if anything, too strong, because they prevent them from, they prevent land improvements, transport improvements, and so on. What England, the sort of balance that England appears to arrive at in, let's say, the 18th century, is it balances strength of property rights with adaptability. I think this is work that Dan Bogart has done, and I think it's very, very persuasive.
All right. And the idea would be that if you strike the right balance, then people have an incentive to economically invest in their property, because they do not have to worry that it's being taken away from them by the state, for example.
Precisely. Yeah.
Okay. So where does your work on this come in then?
Well, a major part of the story is that if you're going to make this claim about property rights, there's a problem with chronology in, let's say, the conventional historiography, which has said that actually property rights in England have been fairly secure, potentially since the end of the 12th century. That if you accept that chronology, you have a problem in that, well, you have secured property rights in England since the end of the 12th century, but it industrializes 6 centuries later. That's a very delayed cause and effect. What I would say my work is interested in is essentially saying, kind of, hold on, property rights, if we take sort of a more expansive definition of it, property rights prior, certainly to the English Civil War, let's say in the century prior to the English Civil War, so about 1540 to 60, actually property rights aren't particularly strong. And, you know, that's one of the reasons why I'm interested in this institution of wardship. But there are other institutions that you could mention in the same time during the same time period, and which I think have been under-researched. For instance, the monopolies, the Crown gives out a lot of monopolies of production and of trade, certainly in the first half of the 17th century. But we don't have a good economic history of how these monopolies operate. I think the last large-scale effort in terms of an economic history of the monopolies came out in 1912.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So we don't really know an awful lot. And I think my suspicion is that once we start, this is something, these are the sorts of questions that say, like, legal history historians have been interested in for a little bit. But I think if we had more economic historians, more historians working in this area, I think it might give us pause about how strong we think property rights are during this period.
Right. Because as you're saying right now, the received wisdom, I suppose, which is based on this paper, the seminal paper by North and Weingast, right, on the Glorious Revolution in the United Kingdom, the simplified version of that idea is that, okay, there was this event that ultimately secured property rights from the crown, and that then ultimately spurred investment, incentivized investment. Part of your work is, as you're saying, to try to complicate that story, to try to make it more accurate, rather not complicated for no reason, right? But rather try to give a more holistic picture. So how do you go about doing so?
Well, I think the North and Weingast paper has been much cited and very interesting for good reason. But though, relatively speaking, they're writing a long time ago. And they're writing at a time when there was probably less sort of empirical information about, let's say, you know, about the relationship between, say, the state and the economy.
Right.
I think a lot of good work's been done by Patrick O'Brien on this, certainly in terms of showing how much, let's say, how tax revenues are increasing, just how much. So in terms of, you know, from a theoretical perspective, I think their paper is still important. But from an empirical perspective, I think it's probably outdated now.
I see. So you're adding to the story empirically as well in your research?
That's certainly how I conceive of it. By looking at one particular institution that existed under the Tudors and early Stuarts, we can sort of start to get a sort of a more fine-grained picture about the relationship between the state and the economy. So, like I say, you know, when I talk about Hall of Wards, you know, we talk about property rights, but perhaps I shouldn't complicate things too quickly, too soon. But there's another issue at play here, which I think wardship is a very good illustration of. And that is that the late Tudor state, the early Stuart state, is exceptionally corrupt and decrepit. The revenues that the crown could be raising through, let's say, things like wardship, through things like monopolies, could potentially be enormous. And yet the English Civil War essentially breaks out because Charles can't pay for an army to stop an invasion from Scotland. So the fiscal tools are potentially there for the crown to raise finances, but it's simply incapable. You can compare that situation with England in the 18th century, where it's essentially able to fund its way to global preeminence. So I think that we've spoken a lot about property rights. We've still not finished that conversation. But I think there are really two key issues here. The capacity of the English state to raise revenues and the effects it has on property rights in its efforts to raise tax.
Right. So you're particularly interested in the time before the Glorious Revolution in the United Yes. Kingdom. Could you give our listeners a idea of how exactly did the political system work at the time? What exactly was the legal system that was operating? And how did the economy look like? Just to sort of give a rough overview of like what was this country like, right? Or this kingdom like at the time?
So in terms of the economy, it is still essentially agrarian. Off the top of my head, I think in about the year 1500, you still had 80% of adult males working in agriculture. Outside of London, which in European terms is becoming a large city, but outside of London, I think the next largest town is Norwich, which has about 20, 25,000 people. So outside of London, you're talking about what is essentially an extremely agrarian economy, still very rural. If you don't live in London, you basically live in a village or a small market town. Mm-hmm. In terms of the legal system, it's different from Europe in that you don't, it's not Roman civil law. It's primarily common law, which is essentially a court / judge based accrual of decisions in court cases, which informs subsequent court cases. Some people might cringe at that, but you know, in one sentence, I'd say that's common law. But it's not entirely that simple, because you also have a system of equity law, which is much more free-formed. And there is, say, at the beginning of the 17th century, a conflict between equity and common law. I should also say that in trying to just simply describe something in England at this time, often defies common sense. So briefly as I could, if I was to say in a nutshell, it's not Roman civil law, which is what you get in the rest of Europe. And in terms of the political system, so you have, of course, at the apex political system, you have the Crown and the Crown's Privy Council. Most executive policy, in fact, I think essentially all executive policy is executed via the Crown and through the Privy Council. The legislature is part of course, is Parliament. That is sometimes called, let's say, in a consultative role. And also on the understanding that it might also be voting taxes with which to fund the Crown. And the fiscal system, the ideal was is that the Crown would live on its own, i.e. that it would be able to essentially fund itself through ancient revenues, you know, for instance, through the Crown lands. But that's increasingly impossible. And that sort of ideal is never really lost. The Crown comes into frequent conflict with Parliament over trying to raise revenues. And I think Conrad Russell, who's an historian of the Civil War, I think if I might sort of recklessly characterise what he's done, that would be to say that essentially that fiscal, let's say, ineptitude of the English Crown is one of the prime causes of the Civil War.
Right. And what are the main expenses of the Crown at the time?
I mean, the Navy, obviously, the Royal Household as well. But we don't. It's a good question, actually, because if you look at the sort of the fiscal records of the period, we have, thanks to O'Brien, we have a very clear idea of all the income. We don't always have a clear idea of what the outgoings are. One of the great things about the Court of Wards is I think it's unique in that it's a revenue raising institution where you can also see where the money's going out. And it's to modernize, you're almost pulling your hair out. Because a lot of the money goes out to pensions and annuities, essentially to pay off royal favourites. I mean, one spin on it, you might say, is that the money is essentially being used to buy the loyalty of the political nation. And in the sort of conventional history of the period, the interpretation is that this is something which Elizabeth does very, very well in terms of the distribution of royal patronage, royal monies. Elizabeth does an exceptional job at this. But her successors, James and Charles, they're much looser with the purse strings, and rather than there being a sort of a more equitable distribution, it goes far more to royal favourites, and that this is one of the reasons why you know essentially the Civil War breaks out, because he doesn't have the loyalty of the political nation.
So as we alluded to earlier, you're studying the Court of Wards and Liveries in this period. So expand real quick. First of all, how did you choose this specific court, and what exactly is the history of this court?
How I ended up, I honestly, I don't think I could give you a good answer. that there have definitely been times, because there's so much material. I'll be lucky to look at the tip of the iceberg. There are times when I think, why on earth did I start doing this? And actually, just a small thing, the records of the Court of Wards, after the court was abolished, they were briefly held in a fish yard in Westminster. So some of them, the stuff is very, your hands will come out black. They're not always nice records to work with. But in terms of its origins, it's essentially medieval. And if anything, is an institution that's even more important than the medieval period. If you look at Magna Carta, third, fourth, fifth, and sixth clauses all relate to the functioning of wardship in 1215, at the beginning of the 13th century. So in terms of its importance, it's in the medieval period, it's considerable. And what it is it, in this period, if you hold land, if freehold land, you don't have a load of your rights over. You hold it of a feudal overlord, specifically the crown. And you hold it of certain tenures. One of these tenures might be socage. And you know that essentially imposes virtually no burden on you. So if you hold socage land of the crown, you might have to pay a small minimum rent, but that's it. Conversely, if you hold land of knight servants, in theory, that obligates you, as the name would suggest, that obligates you to undertake knight service. Mm. Now, the justification for wardship that arises in the medieval period is that what happens when that land descends to an heir who is unable to render that military service? You have a problem if it's a child. So this is when we start to see the legal institution of wardship developing. What the feudal overlord is entitled to do is they're entitled to, first of all, to step in and take custody of the child. Mm-hmm. The theory being that they can sort of raise and train the child to be able to render the knight service that they will be expected to render when they reach adulthood. The feudal overlord also has the right to decide the child's marriage. The idea being they can ensure that the child doesn't marry a familial enemy. Mm. They also have the right to take custody of the land. The idea being that the income from the land can be used to pay for military upkeep whilst the child is still a child. And this system, it goes largely into abeyance over the 14th and 15th centuries. There are various legal devices which are developed to avoid it. But then in 1485, with Henry VII and the re-establishment of central authority in England, wardship is sort of resuscitated. And the Crown does this specifically for the revenues that it hopes to raise by doing so. There is no military justification at this point for knights for wardship.
Interesting. So at the time, this is a relatively long time frame, obviously. But who holds land at this time? Like, how is it? Explain a little bit more, like who these people are that are potentially subject to wardship.
Well, I mean, holding land is essentially synonymous with social status at this period. So that the largest landowner is of course, the crown. Then you will have the peers or tenants in chief, i.e. those who hold land directly. In the early medieval period, in the medieval period, like I said, that would be made, primarily noblemen, knights. By our period, by the Tudors and by the Stuarts, tenants in chief, i.e. those who hold land of the crown, that's sort of filtered down, lower down into the social system. Gentry, they may very well hold land of the crown, in fact, more or not they do. And even yeomen, essentially farmers, they on occasion hold land directly of the crown as well. So one way you can think of it is that, say, in the 12th century, the largest landowners almost certainly hold land of the crown. And over time, smaller and smaller landholders are holding land.
Okay, so does that mean that a larger and larger percentage of the population can potentially become subject to this Court of Wards?
Certainly.
Okay, so how does that play out then?
What I've been able to do is go through the Court of Wards record and compile essentially a time series of the number of descents of land that are resulting in the wardship of the heir. Okay. So essentially the number of wards who are entering the custody of the crown each year.
Right.
And in the 1920s, it's about 20 to 30 children each year. So not that many. If you look at the eve of the Civil War, though, it's about 150 children. So there's a considerable increase in the incidence of wardship over this period. The Crown's able to achieve this in various ways. First of all, the legal devices which people used to be able to adopt to avoid wardship, Henry VIII essentially does away with all of that. And that's a fairly complicated story. And I truthfully, not one I don't think I could relay accurately, sort of orally. But essentially, legal devices which had once been effective in avoiding wardship, that's all gone. The other thing which the Crown does is at the end of the 1530s, is it seizes essentially all of the land held by the monastery. This constituted probably around about 15 to 20% of the whole landed wealth. What does it do with the land? Well, initially it hoped to hold on to it, so it would be a permanent part of the Crown land estate. But fiscal pressures force it to sell it on. So what does it do? It sells it on, but wherever possible, it sells it not in socage tenure, but in knight service. Mm-hmm. So it essentially floods the land market with land that, you know, if it descends to an heir, will incur wardship of the heir. So it does this in the 1530s. And, you know, a century later, you can sort of see the consequences of that because wardship has just become so much more common. And I think that's in large part because of this process whereby the Crown has seized land of the monastery, which incidentally, I think, tells us something about security property rights.
Yeah.
And then it's resold it with this knight service tenure attack.
I see. When the Crown takes wardship through the court, can you walk us through how that process works?
The first step is that the ancestor dies, that the child's, most commonly, of course, the child's father, but it might be an older brother or something like that. But the child's ancestor dies. The court maintained a network of county officers called feodaries. And we don't always have very good records for feodaries. It seems fairly clear that, you know, that they essentially kept tabs on everyone in the county who held land of the Crown. And if one of them died, that would be very difficult to conceal, of course. They would be in a position basically to find out whether or not the heir is of age. After that, they would, in fairly quick order, they would be held what was called an inquisition post-mortem. This wasn't, normally now we have a post-mortem to work out the causes of death. That is emphatically not what a post-mortem is in this period. Rather, the post-mortem is intended to, you know, to identify who the ancestor is, who the land has descended to, by what tenure the land is held, and what its value is. Mm. And you can infer from those questions that the post-mortem was essentially designed for the Crown to enforce its feudal rights, i.e. its rights to wardship. And then after that, you know, it depends, really. Sometimes court's officers would take physical custody of the child almost instantly. They would start collecting rents on the land as well. In other instances, if the child was very, very young, then they'd be left with the family. And then the next step really is essentially for the negotiation process, for the Crown to decide who they're going to sell the child and their lands on to. Mm. Sometimes if the family is lucky, they're able to buy it back. And this proportion changes. So under Elizabeth, it's about a quarter of the time the family is able to buy the ward back and the land as well. But of course, if it's a quarter of the time, then three quarters of the time it's going to a third party. That proportion increases so that under the Stuarts, it's about half of the time. So yeah, that was essentially the next step of the process, to decide who the Crown was going to sell the child onto. And then, of course, the child would either be returned to their family if they'd ever left, or they'd be delivered onto the third party. So you can see what's rather sad to our eyes is you can see the injunctions that are being issued by the court. And a lot of them are related to orders to the family to relinquish the child to whoever it's been sold onto.
Yeah, that is really quite crazy. Was that considered, or do Scottish generally consider this a form of serfdom, or how is this categorized usually?
Well, to modernize, it's abhorrent. You don't want to judge the past on your terms. You need to judge it on by its own. All right, okay, so we can do that in the case of wardship. And there are sort of two forms of evidence that enable us to say, actually, wardship was abhorrent to contemporaries as well. First of all, foreign observers, they, of course, because they have Roman civil law, they don't have a system of wardship. It really is only in England, Scotland and Ireland that wardship exists. And foreign observers are just appalled by it. For instance, you can look at the letters that Venetian ambassadors write back home. Hmm. You know, they think wardship is insane. They think it's cruel and abhorrent. Same also with the Spanish. When they were preparing the Armada for the invasion of England, They also prepared what was going to be their agenda of domestic policy when they successfully invaded England. One of the things they wanted to do was abolish wardship because they knew it'd be a fairly, fairly low cost, low hanging fruit in terms of securing the loyalty of the political country, of the political nation. And then, of course, we have what English contemporaries. The comparison they always make is to cattle market, that wardship is essentially, it's like the buying and selling of livestock.
I mean, I guess that's somewhat encouraging to hear, I suppose. you mentioned some statistics concerning the prevalence of this tool, but how relevant was it for the crown in terms of fiscal revenue?
So again, there are good records for the court in terms of what its income is. Under Mary and Edward, so this would be 1547 to 1558, well, with some volatility, it probably equivalent to around about 5% of total crown income. Under Elizabeth, that percentage declines, so it's about 2 to 3. And then it increases again, so that under Charles, I think it reaches about 8 to 9%. And on the eve of the Civil War, I think it's either the third or second most important item of income for the crown. But that, fairly significant. And certainly the crown is so cash-strapped that it would have struggled to do away without the monies that it raised. But wardship, in terms of its utility to the crown, also served a second, perhaps more important function than the money that it was able to raise, was in that it was able to use wards as a means of patronage for rewarding royal servants. Certainly under Elizabeth, that was probably what it's indirectly, that's what its most important source of income was.
Right. But obviously also that it tells us something about the security of property rights at the time, right? As you alluded to earlier. So how big would you say, or how relevant for the property rights climate at the time, would you say was this practice?
So you have it in a direct sense. Mm-hmm. That the land passes more often than not to a third party. So what are your incentives when you have that land? You might only have it for 4 or 5 years until the child reaches their age of majority, i.e. when they reach the age of 21. So as I said, what's your incentives? You don't care about it in the long run. It doesn't belong to you. It's not going to belong to you in 10 years. So people who purchase wardships behave as you would expect. They essentially engage in asset stripping. They overcrop the land. There are cases of houses being pulled apart so that they can take the building materials. The classic example is cases of forests and woods being chopped down so they can sell on the timber. So in an immediate sense, and of course the family is helpless to prevent any of that, in principle, families and heirs could have prosecuted guardians for this sort of behaviour. But when you look in practice at what actually happens, it's essentially impossible. There's a case in Kent where a child comes of age. They prosecute the guardian for chopping down woods valued at about £2,000. Court of Wards agrees with them, so they fine the guardian £13.
Mm.
So it's insane. You're never going to you've just got to suck it up. You're not going to go through all the trouble of prosecuting someone in court when you're not going to get anything back. So you've got that immediate sense in terms of people's lands being laid waste. But you also have indirect ways in which I think wardship and the tenures which underpin it interfere, let's say, with the land market or with ways in which you might want to improve land. For instance, lands which are held by knight service, they sell at a 10% discount relative to lands held by socket. We talked about this being essentially an agrarian economy. Land is the major store of value. Put another way, the capital stock is being significantly diminished by the existence of wardship and the tenures that underpin it. You also, like I say, you have the tenure of socage, tenure of knight service, and that as a component of, let's say, a regulatory framework where land improvements are very difficult. This is an additional complicating factor, which again essentially prevents effective land improvements. A good example of that would be the drainage of the Fens, marshland just north of Cambridge. Now, when they begin the works in 1630, they're told that the drained land will be held by Sockage. They finish in 1637, and the crown turns around and says, oh, by the way, actually, no, you don't hold it by Sockage, you hold it by knight service. You can imagine how unhappy you would be about that piece of news. And of course, you know, they've expended all of this money, and they've just seen that the value of their investment cut by 10%, essentially by the crown turning around and checking. So that's the sort of regulatory environment you're in when you're trying to consider, when you're trying to think about land improvements. It's no surprise to my mind that you start, you know, once you have major changes in the regulatory framework in 1660 and 1688, and what happens in 1660 is all of the tenures which underpin wardship, they're all done away with, that you start to see an increase in these land improvement projects going.
Interesting. Would you say that ultimately strengthens the Northern Wynegast argument? How do you feel like it interacts with that original story?
I would consider it in terms of their broad conceptual schema. I actually consider it to be very sympathetic, frankly. I don't think you could call the early Stuart, late Tudor state absolutist. You would like to be, but it's not effective enough. But this isn't an environment where, courtesy of the constitutional framework, that property rights are particularly strong. There is an improvement when that constitutional framework changes in 1660 and 1688. The gloss that I would put on it is that 1688, that's not the be-all and end-all.
Right.
Probably a more important event, certainly in terms of state capacity, is the English Civil War, the Protectorate, and then the Restoration Settlement in 1660. In this respect, I entirely agree with O'Brien. Patrick O'Brien, in that it's not 1688 as such, rather it's this whole half century of constitutional change from, let's say, around about 1640 to around about 60, and that's what's critical. I would wholeheartedly agree with that.
Yeah, that's really interesting. I mean, on the one hand, you know, I think your scholarship here ultimately shows how, I think it makes, on the one hand, a very subtle point, right? That like different kinds of property rights, not just in terms of their security over time, but also in terms of what exactly are the strings attached to different property rights regimes. Mm-hmm. They have different effects on the incentives in terms of what kind of economic activity I'm going to be engaged in, right? Because as you were mentioning, right, it's not that people who are holding these properties for short periods of times in an intermediary sense weren't engaging with these economically at all. Right, because you could make the argument, well, why invest in the property, because you're just going to have to give it up. Well, exactly, but that's then incentivized a very specific kind of economic activity, right, where they're, as you're saying, asset stripping effectively. So would you say there's possibly a little bit too much emphasis in this literature on the security of property rights in a temporal sense, and too little understanding of how these specificities of property rights law ultimately then translate into economic incentives?
I think that's very well put, actually. I don't know if I could put it better myself. Let's say about security of property rights. The land is almost invariably returned to the child once they reach their age of majority, right, which for males is 21. So in that respect, you could say, well, actually, your security of land title, that's never really under threat. But I think that's a narrow construction of things, and I think like you say, once you sort of look at the specifics of how it's actually working, what the economic consequences of it are, I think you have a more nuanced picture, and one that's certainly more supportive of what Northern Wynegast have to say.
And I mean, you cite this 10% in value difference, but I would assume that in some cases, you know, the value drops significantly more than that, right, of a land title. If it's the case that, you know, for 5 or 6 years, someone effectively destroys the land to a certain extent, right? Like, I'm not sure that's really just going to be a 10% drop, at least sort of in my lifetime, right? If I'm not really going to be able to use this land productively for 5 years afterwards, right? Because I don't know, maybe the soil is completely destroyed or something like this, then it might be worth to me significantly less than just a 10% decline.
Possibly, but the thing is, I can, in terms of what sources are available, I can only really look at land values or other, the easy way in is only to really look at land values prior to, let's say, you know, the cataclysm of entering wardship. So you can only really see, you know, this is it, it's the 10% discount on the land when you pay for it, which sort of equates to the chances of that cataclysm befalling you, or rather your heir. You don't have to worry about it, your heir may do. There'll certainly be instances where you could lose a lot more than the equivalent 10% of the value of the land, you know, if you're foregoing 5-6 years income. Conversely, there'll be other times when you incur this 10% discount, but you reach an age where your heir reaches the age of majority. Right. So you know they're going to be able to inherit it without any of these problems. So there'll be other times when you've essentially bought the land at a 10% discount, but because your heir is of age and hopefully their heir is as well, you never actually have to pay any of the consequences. In that respect, wardship is kind of arbitrary, really.
Right.
And I was just going to say that there are cases of families where they enter wardship, then their child enters wardship, and then over a series of generations, the estate is just entirely dissipated.
Oh, wow. Okay. Are you able to report or document any other ways in which people change their behavior as a result of this institution? In sort of possible anticipation that this might happen to them or to their heirs, as you say?
One area which, so the short answer is yes, land conveyancing. The buying and selling of land, it's been established that the transaction costs involved with buying and selling land is very important in terms of how productively it's going to be used. It appears that the complexities of tenure significantly increase the costs of conveyancing land in this period. But I say that, I've not found a really, that's kind of on the to-do list, really. And I'm not entirely sure how I'm going to do it either. It's all very well sort of collecting contemporary evidence, you know, contemporary comment on it. But sort of dig in a little bit and look at the mechanics of how this is sort of increasing the costs of transactions. That's proving difficult to do. At the moment, I'm simply at a point where I can simply sort of really observe the phenomenon, but I can't measure it.
All right, that makes sense.
Talking about the fiscal capacity of the industry.
Ah, yes.
Because wardship, you know, it imposes a tremendous burden on children and their families. And you would imagine that putting it in simplistic terms, for every pound monetary burden that it imposes on the family, you would hope that pound is going to the crown and that it's able to spend it effectively. But wardship, and it would appear with the other instruments adopted by the Tudors and early Stuarts, is horribly inefficient. It's difficult to put numbers on it because it is so corrupt, and so much money is essentially ending up in the pockets of the third parties who buy wardships or in crown officers. I mentioned the feodaries. They're certainly lining their pockets. It's very difficult to say, but you know, because of the nature of it. But certainly third parties and crown officers are earning multiples of what's going to the crown. And the thing is wardship is not unique in this respect. Say, for instance, income from crown lands. Contemporaries thought that for every £10, or rather for every pound that went to the crown, £10 went to other sources. And this is repeated again and again in the sort of fiscal instruments that the crown adopts. It's terribly inefficient. And wardship is a very, very good illustration of this, because it could potentially have been extremely remunerative for the and that would have gone some way to allaying some of the political and social costs and the economic costs that it imposes, but it doesn't. It's essentially a sort of a gross means of wealth redistribution, where wealth is drawn from the gentry and goes to crown officers. That's the flow of money here. Virtually nothing actually ends up with the crown.
Interesting. Yeah, and to what extent is this then also related to, as you say, later political turmoil? Is that sort of like a major reason for discontent? Is that just one of, as you say, like just an enormous number of inefficiencies and corrupt practices that ultimately channel that kind of instability?
Probably the latter. I'll put it like this: there's a very, very rich historiography on the causes of the English Civil War, and you know, I'm an economic historian. It's not that's definitely not my expertise.
Right.
But yes, in brief, you know, there's a rebellion in Scotland at the end of the 1630s. The crown has no money with which to put it down. It just cannot pay for the instruments of coercion to end this. And in an immediate respect, you could say, yeah, the fiscal decrepitude of the crown means that ultimately it's incapable of sustaining itself.
Sean Bottomley, thank you so much.
Thank you very much. I've really enjoyed it.
Thank you for listening to the Political Economy Forum podcast. Please feel free to listen to our other episodes on iTunes, SoundCloud, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. You might also like our special podcast on election security, Neither Free Nor Fair, which is hosted by Professor James Long and is also available on all major platforms.
Our podcasts are produced by Morgan Wack and myself, Nicholas Vichtuk. Our theme music was created by Ted Long.
Please feel free to leave a review as we're curious about your feedback. And if you have any questions, suggestions, or concerns, please contact uwpoliticaleconomy@gmail.com. We would love to hear from you.